You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. The program you are about to hear is part of the Virginia Festival of the Book, held in Charlottesville, Virginia, from March 21st through 25th, 2012. The festival was sponsored by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. It was originally recorded in the City of Charlottesville Council Chambers by Charlottesville's TV 10.
Welcome. My name is Michelle Prosser, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Virginia Festival of the Book and the Charlottesville Company of Friends and Scarlet Publicity. You are here for the program that's called Beyond Reason, Lessons from Loss. And our authors, which I'm going to go into depth with a little more in just a minute, are Pamela Blair, I Wasn't Ready to Say Goodbye, Surviving, Coping, and Healing After the Sudden Death of a Loved One, and Greg Corbin, who wrote Beyond Reason. And so let me tell you a few things. First of all, we want to remind you to turn off your cell phones if they haven't gotten turned off. And sometimes our panelists have to do that. I always have a panic attack to make sure I've done it. Let me tell you a little bit about our sponsors today before we go in. First of all, the Virginia Festival of the Book is free of charge, but it's not free of cost. It's very expensive. So please remember to go online and give back or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk. The evaluations are very important. When you get them handed out, please give them back to us because they continue to allow us to support this. And we urge you to do everything you can to support the festival. The Quest Bookstore is another sponsor. I don't know if any of you all have actually been able to be at the Quest Bookstore yet, but if you want to stroll down Main Street, I call it my sanctuary. It's just a lovely place to go and find spiritual soul food. And I'd like to recognize Janet and Kay, who are here with the bookstore. Could you guys raise your hands? Thank you. All right, well, let me tell you a little bit about our other two sponsors. The Charlottesville Company of Friends is part of the Readers Network of Fast Company Magazine, and they're an engaged group of folks who are innovative, often are business people, but we've had all sorts of topics for them to come here throughout the years. So we often have a lot of not just book festival people here, but people from the Charlottesville community that come. Scarlet Publicity, Sarah, could you raise your hand? And Leonard? Scarlet Publicity she told me I'm not allowed to say much because she doesn't want it to sound like an ad, but she's my publicist, she's Greg's publicist, she's Pam's publicist, so that's a pretty good affirmation. And if you want energy and authenticity, she's the one to have if you're thinking about being a writer. All right, well, let's go on to the main part of the show. What we're going to do is we're going to have our authors speak, and then the three of us are going to engage a little bit in a discussion. And then we're going to come down and be kind of more interactive in terms of you all being able to ask questions. So first, they're going to tell a little bit of their story. Then we're going to have a discussion, then we'll be down there with you. I always forget to say something about myself, and people always say, well, what about you? So please forgive me. I'm not trying to do any self-promotion, but this is enough feedback that I've heard that I'll share with you. I'm a Charlottesville native, and I'm an executive coach and trainer, and now the manager of employee development and training at Loomis Corporation, and I'm also an author. It's called Excuse Me, Your God is Waiting, Love Your God, Create Your Life, Find Your True Self. And as you'll find through this discussion, we have a lot in common because I had my first child die. So this topic is very dear to my heart, although I promise you that it will be a very uplifting spin on this, because for me at least it was a gift in that I found spirituality much deeper and became much more in touch with what was important in life. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about our authors. Dr. Corbin is an anesthesiologist and graduate of Duke University School of Medicine. As an assistant professor of anesthesiologist at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, he was involved in research and teaching. Oh, I didn't ask you how to say this word. Neuro. I briefed everything.
Neuroanesthesiologist.
Regional anesthesia. Regional
anesthesia.
Okay, and pain medication. I went through with him and had him brief me on everything except that sentence. He's also assistant professor of anesthesiology at the University of Virginia Medical Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. He has a long-standing interest in outdoor education and is a senior facilitator at UVA's Popular Ridge Challenge course. So in a way, you have two coaches up here, and then you have someone who often is very much like a coach in that he's working in a challenge course. Well, an undergraduate at Duke, he created a week-long adventure course for incoming freshmen now called Project Wild, which is Wilderness Initiative Learning at Duke, which became a model for many universities' outdoor programs. He holds a black belt in taekwondo, so don't mess with him, a brown belt in judo, and has logged over 40,000 miles as a bicycle commuter. He's known challenge and pain, but it was only through the death of his son that he found their common source. He is currently a director of an outpatient surgery center in Central Virginia, where he lives in the Blue Ridge Mountains with his wife, Catherine, and their two children. He's authored books and research articles and developed new techniques that are widely used in his field. So please welcome Greg. Pamela Blair is also another doctor. She is a PhD. She has offices in Westchester County, New York, and Fairfield County, Connecticut. As a therapist, she's known for holistic approach and innovative spiritual growth workshops and support groups. A frequently invited guest on TV, cable, and radio talk shows. In fact, she was just telling me about her experience of being on Geraldo. Dr. Blair has appeared as an expert on CBS TV. She's the co-author of the award-winning best-selling classic on grief entitled I Wasn't Ready to Say Goodbye, Surviving, Coping, and Healing After the Sudden Death of a Loved One, as well as the companion workbook. She's also the author of, and I love this title, I have to tell you, mm-hmm. and many of the women in the audience, men, The Next 50 Years, A Guide for Women at Midlife and Beyond. Dr. Blair earned her PhD in philosophy and a master's in metaphysics from the American Institute of Holistic Theology. She has certificates in integrative therapy and therapeutic touch. She has studied at the New England Educational Institute and the Transformational Training Institute and has an interfaith divinity degree from the New Seminary in New York, New York. Please welcome Pam. So, Greg, we'd like to first kind of hear your story. I thought when I was designing this program that it made sense to start with a personal story first. And something how somebody's gone through in their life and what they learned, and then have Pam kind of take us up to a higher level in terms of what are people going through in general. And one of the really interesting things about Pam is that her book really took off after 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was quite, and she can talk to that a little bit, but it was quite a support for people who had such a shock. So we're going to start with the personal and then expand out in terms of how people work through this and what are some of the gifts that come in a situation like this. Yeah. So go ahead, Greg.
Thank you all for coming. Before my son Brian died, which is the subject of my book, I probably wouldn't have come to a talk about grief. Like most physicians, I discovered later, I was very afraid of death, very ill at ease at funerals. And if I had a dying patient, I'd get out of the room as quickly as I could. So it'd be like, only the good die young. And then I'd be out the door, which is actually fairly common. But I had a life-changing experience through my son, Brian, who was 9 when he died. And it rocked my world. And left me with several questions. The first was, what do you do when your own experiences should be impossible according to everything you've been taught? How can a child know the future? Brian, the joy of my life, an incredibly gifted child, very full of life. And, of course, the death of a child like that is one of the worst things that you could ever imagine. So I was sad. Brian, however, who knew more than I did, was joyful. His last day on earth was the most joyful, and as he died, he was the happiest boy you could ever imagine. And he knew this was coming, whereas, of course, that was totally not in my belief system. So I learned a lot about him now, and from him. One more thing, let me say before I get into the story, is that after he died, I had all these questions. And it turns out that living here in Charlottesville, I was fortunate to find probably the best teachers in the world to answer these questions that happened to live here. Okay? When I moved here 31 years ago to teach at the medical school, this was a nice college town in a beautiful setting. I had no idea that since the time of Jefferson, Charlottesville seems to be attracting people at the forefront of human consciousness. And I happened to, through lots of synchronicities, meet them, and they became my teachers. People like Robert Monroe wrote the first books in the Western literature about out-of-body experiences. Raymond Moody opened up the whole idea of life after death. Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote the book Magical Child, etc. Ian Stevenson, Reincarnation. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross studied with Robert Monroe. All of these people became my teachers, and there was really, I'm very indebted to them for teaching me a lot of things that I hope to convey shortly. So the details were that Brian was a healthy 9-year-old, and right before his 9th birthday, he came up to us as we were planning his party and said he didn't want a party, and it would just bring his death closer, and that he wouldn't live till double digits, meaning age 10. There was no reason for this. He was healthy. He'd had heart surgery as a baby, but that had gone well, and we were told he should be normal, and he felt normal. So we took him to a pediatrician, and then he became more and more depressed and became obsessed with thoughts of death, had trouble sleeping. And my wife is a minister and pastoral counselor, and she used all her skills, but Brian still got progressively more despondent. So then we took him to a psychologist, and they became great friends. Brian loved learning about psychology from the psychologist, and the psychologist said that Brian taught him more about the workings of a child's brain than anybody else he'd been with. But they never discovered any issues to deal with. But nonetheless, Brian really liked the attention and the experience. About three weeks before Brian died in the spring, he started coming out of his depression, became very joyful, became his old self again. Now, his old self was, he was an exceptional kid. He wrote beautiful poetry, and he always was doing something to create chaos or joy. He always had some projects going on in the neighborhood with the other kids. He loved being on stage. He was a real showman. And about 3 weeks before he died, he announced that it was time for his birthday party, but it was a belated birthday party, and it was going to be called a Happy Spring Party. No presents and just his best friends. About that time, there were lots of things going on that I didn't realize were possible, but the latest picture, photograph we had of him began to fade. And he and his younger sister, Lynn, who was mentally handicapped, became obsessed with butterflies, and butterflies everywhere. Stories about butterflies, pictures, little window prisms, and the house was inundated with butterflies. He started putting up signs on his door, you know, keep out Brian's room, this means you, and things like that. And then his favorite comic strip was Calvin and Hobbes. Now, Calvin and Brian were very much alike. Brian would get ideas, one of which was we were out and on a date, and the babysitter phoned us from the bathroom saying that Brian had locked her in. Okay, he got that from Calvin and Hobbes, okay? So we had to negotiate in the restaurant for her release. And
Calvin also had a parents pole that he used to torment his parents. And so Brian thought this was a good idea, too. So whenever we told Brian to do something he didn't like clean up his room, the next day there would be a parents pole posted, you know, prominently showing our low approval ratings and stuff like that. So 2 days before Brian died, my wife came home and saw Brian pulling his little wagon full of his camping gear and his teddy bears. And she said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Well, it's time for me to go on my trip." Mm-hmm. And Catherine said, "Well, if you go, I'll miss you terribly." And Brian said, "You don't understand. It's something I have to do. I can't be a wimp. I have to go." So she got out of the car and sat down next to him and put him on her lap. And they talked for a while. And then she said, "Well, I'll tell you what. You have your party the day after tomorrow. So you need to stay for that. So why don't we pitch the tent and you can camp out the night before your party, and that'll be your trip for now." And he thought that was a good idea. He'd always been afraid of the dark. He tried that before. But now he felt like he could do it. So he turned around and happily pulled his wagon back to the house. The next day we got the house ready for the party. It was very festive. We pitched the tent. He spent the night with his dog, Sasha. And the next morning he came in so proud of himself for conquering his fear of the dark. It was the most beautiful spring day. That was the day he died. And it was unusual that the air was full of honeysuckle and that the air was crisp and clear. It was like the most beautiful day. Even then, before I knew what was going to go on, I just remarked to my wife, "This is the most beautiful spring day I've ever seen." The universe was kind of orchestrating things in ways that I didn't think were possible. Brian's friends came. They had their happy spring party, and he got his non-physical gifts. His best friend wrote a song for him. His girlfriend gave him a kiss, and another little boy gave him a hug. Now, Brian also, in the last 3 weeks, had been tying up all of his loose ends, and one of which was inviting Cammy, who'd always wanted to be friends with him. So he went to his room, finished up some things, and then I took him to his baseball game. And he'd always been afraid of the baseball. He was the littlest kid on the team, and this was only his second game. And on the way to the baseball field, he said he wanted to score a run more than anything. We got to the baseball field. He was a different kid. He lost his fear of the baseball, and he was charging after the ground balls and leaping up after the fly balls, and he was so enthusiastic. It was like a new kid. And he begged the coach to put him in at pitcher, which he wasn't good enough to do. But he came up to bat. He was little. He got walked to first base. To the next little boy, hit a triple, and Brian ran around the bases, and the coach waved him home, and the crowd was cheering, and he looked over at me and gave me the thumbs up. As he crossed home plate, he was the happiest boy you ever saw. He trotted over the dugout. Everybody was giving him high fives, and he went into the dugout, sat down, and he had an arrhythmia, and he died. And then I tried to resuscitate him, but something in an anesthesiologist, that's what we do. But something told me he wasn't coming back. So that was the end of Brian's life. But the story really just started getting interesting then. I can't really go into too much of it in the time that I've got, maybe a little bit later. But all of these strange paranormal things that I'd been taught were impossible started happening to me. I learned a lot. And now, people usually mostly like to hear about the story when I'm doing an interview. But I'm going to tell you, they don't want to hear so much about what I learned. But I learned a lot. I had so many wonderful teachers. And let me just give you a few little short readings regarding some of the things that I learned. Since Brian's death, I've had many mystical experiences. And when the powerful blow-me-away moments come, it is because I'm feeling the same pure love that I felt with Brian in the center of the vortex, which I talk about. This is always what powers the big changes, and it is incredibly intelligent, arranging experiences with split-second timing in ways I could not have imagined. And when it is done with me, I see things in new ways. One thing I've seen is that to heal, I need to feel two things, pure love and pure pain. Thoughts are almost secondary. They are the changing faces covering the timeless essential qualities I need to heal. At the center of every problem, often masked, is the pain of something that needs healing. If I can find this pain, focus on it, then feel the love from the vortex, something always comes together. I need not understand it all, just accept the thoughts, feelings, and experiences that come. Sometimes I heal parts of myself, and sometimes I heal into something larger, but the process always involves feelings of pain and love. Now, one thing when afterwards I went to the Compassionate Friends, the support group for parents that have lost children, and I started hearing the same things over and over, the same kind of dreams. And with my own dreams and my wife's dreams, they really formed a very strong pattern. I wrote about that in the book. And I also learned from hearing the same stories and then watching myself go through the grieving process that what I saw happening was all of the things that distract you from how much you love somebody. I mean, I loved my son very much. I would have died for him. I thought I was a very loving parent. But after he died, I realized that all of the things that were distractions, did he brush his teeth, was he having trouble at school, all the things you worry about, they went away. And what was left was a love that was purer than anything that I had known before. It was unconditional. All the conditions were going away. And I got to appreciate, in a lot of different ways, the power of this unconditional love. So what I talk about is part of the grieving experience. Having experienced its power and been reminded many times to let go of the conditions of Brian's life, I can be with others who are grieving their own losses. I can feel their love and pain, but I do not suffer with them because I see where their path is leading. They are letting go of their known conditions so they can create something new. Maybe they will lose their fear of death. Maybe they will gain new abilities and insights, or their lives will take a new and more creative direction. I do not know what will change. All I know is that healing grief is the most powerful and transforming process I have witnessed. Okay, so in the middle of the book, I tell about what I learned, and basically, that all the things that I was told, the stages of grief, didn't happen. Grief doesn't really work like that, I discovered. I learned a lot, okay, and I tried to put it as well as I could without distracting from Brian's story, which is really the main storyline. And the end of the book, the magical things that Brian created in his life and his death became stronger. The world I lived in changed. So let me just give you a little hint of what that might be. Now, the apple trees in our house had never borne apples. And the fall after Brian died, for the first time, they produced incredibly fruitful, the most delicious bright red apples. So that was the first time. Then the next year, they didn't produce anything. And then Catherine was pregnant with our next child, Matthew. The apple trees helped celebrate our joy at Matthew's birth by giving us another bumper crop of large, delicious apples. The weight of the lush fruit was too much for one of the old ones to bear, and it fell over, bringing delight to the deer, who could now reach all the ripe apples, not just the ones on the lower branches. I watched the deer feast from its dying limbs as it offered its final gifts to this world. It reminded me of Brian. After it was gone, we planted a strong new tree in its place, and now there are four again, as we are four again with Matthew. The trees have been very kind to us. Let's see. So I have one little passage, but how am I doing on time?
Why don't we go ahead and have you do it at another point?
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
So I was very fortunate to have a magical child who taught me that magic is really all around. And if you can be like a child, your world really can be a wonderful place, much different than what we're taught.
Mm. Thank you. What a privilege it is to be on this panel with Greg, and what a profound story he has to tell, a story of transformation, using his creativity to work through his grief. You're an inspiration. My book is called I Wasn't Ready to Say Goodbye, and it sounds like Brian was ready on some many levels. It's a book that deals with sudden loss, and let me just tell you why I wrote it very briefly. After my former husband died, the father of my son died suddenly of a brain aneurysm, I looked around for a book on sudden death, death that happens without the long lingering year or 2 years of cancer or something like that. I couldn't find anything. And my philosophy has always been, if you can't find something, it means you're supposed to create it. So there you go. And I was fortunate enough to run into a woman who also wanted to write, Brooke Noel, and she and I got together. We locked ourselves in hotel rooms all around the country, and we wrote and we wrote and we wrote. And then we decided that we were going to put out emails to people who had similar experiences and interview as many people as we could, find as many stories out there as we could, and we've included, there's so many that didn't make it into this book. If you're one of those people who did respond to us and you didn't get in our book, trust me, your stories meant an awful lot to us. But we had to, you know, because publishers don't like 1,000-page books often, except for War and Peace, we had to be careful. I want to talk about three goals that I think are very important after the death of a loved one. Now, let's decide. Sudden death for you may be finding out that your husband or boyfriend or child was going to die sometime in the next 3 months. And I've gotten letters from people from all over the world saying that the book was helpful to them even though there was a lingering death. So I just wanted to clarify that. So whatever sudden death means to you, that's what this book is written for. There are three goals as far as I see them. One is learning to live with it. Learning to live with the death of a loved one. Second goal, creating meaning out of their life or their death or both. And creating meaning is a general topic, meaning, and underneath that is creativity of some kind. And creativity can be a capital C, like writing, a new musical piece, or it can be a small C, something that you do to honor the person in some creative way. And the third goal is to move on. Madeleine L'Engle says that we don't get over the deepest pains in our lives. We learn to live with them and move on. Move on, of course, doesn't mean forgetting. It's been how many years, Greg?
19.
19 years since the loss of his son. He's not forgotten, is he? But Greg has certainly moved on. I believe in moving from the unfortunate death, the untimely death, from unfortunate to the fortune in it. Every life and every loss has a fortune built into it. So one of the goals is to move from the unfortunate to the fortune in it. And if you take anything away with you today, I'm hoping that you'll take that. Greg talked a little bit about the stages of grief. Kubler-Ross did a beautiful piece of work and research. However, with sudden death and a lot of deaths, the stages of grief do not apply because you can have them all in one day or 1 hour. The shock, the denial, the pain, the guilt, the anger, the bargaining, the depression, the acceptance can come and go in waves. And what one has to learn to do is to ride the wave. It comes and it does go. But it comes at the most unpredictable moments. I call them, Marilyn, help me with the word we talked about at dinner. Getting ambushed. Okay. Marilyn's my sister, by the way. She contributed to both of my books. She's a genius poet. So, you know, you can be ambushed at any time. I remember one of my ambushes happened in the A&P supermarket in New York, and my former husband loved Campbell's tomato soup, and in the soup aisle, I had an absolute breakdown because I saw his soup. And it was as if the soup can had come off the shelf and cracked me in the skull, and I was brought to my knees. So it can happen at any time. I'd like to read to you the opening of my book, which I think gives you a little bit of insight into my philosophy. I believe, no matter how much pain we're in, there is something inside of us stronger than the pain. That something allows survivors of the worst tragedies to want to live and tell their stories. You can see it in the eyes of someone who has managed to hang on to their dignity in the midst of adversity. It's a kind of stubbornness. You can call it God, the soul, or the human spirit. It's found only when we have been oppressed or broken or abandoned, and we remain the one who holds on to what is left. It is this inner something that has allowed me to go on in the face of tremendous loss. And now I spoke to you about the three major goals, which one of them is creating meaning. And as an example of that, I'd like to read to you just a few paragraphs that explain how I feel about that. I tell my story. Now, this book is full of stories. It's also full of great advice, and I don't want to sound like a commercial, so forgive me if I do. I tell my story because I believe in the power of story to heal. As a therapist and workshop leader, I find it rewarding to help others tell their story. The stories I hear about loss are as diverse as fingerprints, each one slightly different from the next. And yet, when we gather, like we did at a recent workshop or even here today, there's a connection that happens. Each of us connects immediately and profoundly. Regardless of where we are in the process of loss, we become supportive as we relate and recognize each other's pain. A sense of community and acceptance is vital to our spiritual and emotional healing. So if there are any of you out there who are dealing with tremendous loss, do not do it alone. In her book, The Fruitful Darkness, Buddhist anthropologist and depth psychologist Joan Halifax reflects on our collective as well as our personal stories when she writes, I love this. Stories are our protectors, like our immune system, defending against attacks of debilitating alienation. They are the connective tissue between culture and nature, self and other, life and death, that sew the worlds together, and in telling, the soul quickens and comes alive. One of the things that can happen with people who have experienced loss of any kind is that they need to tell their stories. They need to tell a story or many stories about the person they lost, and sometimes our friends and relatives get tired. I see lots of heads going up and down. They don't want to hear it over and over and over and over. But it is essential, if you are helping someone going through the grief process, to try and be patient. Let them tell their story or encourage them to write it down, like Greg has done, right? In his classic book, Reaching Out, Henry Nouwen writes that through our story, though our story can be hard to tell, full of disappointments and frustrations, deviations and stagnations, it is the only story we have, and there will be no hope for the future when the past remains unconfessed, unreceived, and misunderstood. Hopefully, the stories and information in this book will help you feel less alone as you struggle to find a pathway through your grief. One of the questions I get, and we may get it when I get down there, and I don't mind answering it 1,000 times, do we ever get over our grief? It's a lifetime process, sorry. It becomes less stinging after a time, but it is a lifetime process. It's been many years now. Let's see, my son's 32, he was 12 when George died. Okay, it's 20 years. I can still get a pang every so often when I think of what my husband is missing in his son's life. It's unfortunate. However, I also believe that there is a spiritual connection between George and I. And I can go way into that, and that's another book entirely. So, and my the publicist is over there shaking her head. Well, yeah, okay, put that one on the list. Do we ever get over grief? And I just want to read you something a little bit more from Madeleine L'Engle, who had her own losses in her life, including her dearly beloved husband. The way we perceive grief changes over time is conveyed in Madeleine L'Engle's quote at the start of the book. You don't get over it, you just get through it. You don't get by it because you can't get around it. It doesn't get better, it just gets different every day. Grief puts on a new face. My sister, who I really have a great deal of respect for and who's sitting in the audience, wrote a beautiful poem for the book called Pathfinder. Do I have time to read her poem? Okay. After the sudden death of her husband, and what's very coincidental is my sister and I have had the same spiritual path. I'm convinced of it, that we're twins of some kind, even though we're not. Her husband died within 6 months of mine of the identical aneurysm in the brain. Here's her poem. You learn to take a little bit extra on the in-breath, just in case you come up short when heartbreak comes. You learn to lean a little less than most, just enough to catch yourself and keep a balance should you start to fall toward the abyss. You learn to love a little bit more intensely should life send grief to poke you in the eye and a golden moment pass unseen. You learn to speak the language of the heart more clearly to the ones you love, just because there's so many ways the night can come and stop you in your tracks, so many ways the boot can crush the rose. That, and Marilyn did write a piece, not only the poem, but a piece about her own journey through grief in this book, as have others of my clients and, again, the people that we interviewed online. I'm still getting, through Amazon, the most incredible stories I've ever heard of loss. And I read every single one of them, every single letter I receive. So I'd like to end with the update that I wrote for the new version. It's been updated since it first came out in 2000, a year before the 9/11 tragedy. The publisher was kind enough to make sure that every single family of the 9/11 tragedy received a copy without charge of this book in a very beautiful gift box package of some kind. I also saw it the week after it came out. Somebody at the Oklahoma City bombings was walking around on TV with a book under their. That was a nice affirmation for me. Here we go. I still feel the loss. I also feel the new life it gave me. In every loss, there lies a hidden possibility. It stays hidden until one shakes it loose, like that lost sock that ends up in the corner of the newly washed fitted sheet. It's there. You just need to ruffle up that sheet a bit, and out it comes. Where does sudden loss take us? It takes us to places we never asked to visit. It takes us on uncharted, mysterious, unfamiliar journeys to the depths of our souls, where we clatter and crash about, slog through the molasses of grief, and come out the other side. That's all. I'm here to tell you that one can survive that mess and come out the other side, and that although death surely ends a life, it never ends a relationship. There's a lot more to this book, and I'm very, very proud of it. I know my co-author has started all kinds of grief support groups all over the country. There's websites. She's no longer available for speaking engagements, but I am. Because she's moved on to some other things in her life. Her brother died of anaphylactic shock after a bee sting, and he was in his 20s out fishing very happily that day. I do believe there is a very important spiritual journey awaiting you if you have had a loss in your lives, and if you want to connect with that person, you go right ahead. You're not crazy if you are feeling them around you or you're getting signs. So any questions that you have that have to deal with the spiritual side of this journey, please don't hesitate to ask me, and I'm sure Greg would be glad to.
Hey. Yeah. Well, we're going to have a little discussion now. I am so struck. As I was sitting here, I was thinking I had never really thought of my daughter's death as sudden death, because I had had a fertility treatment. I was pregnant with her. At 5 months, she was diagnosed with a severe heart defect. Oh. But I was told over and over again, she's the safest in you, and then at birth, and it's when she gets older, mm-hmm. when she's going to have problems, and she died at birth. Mm. So as I hear you talk, I think, and I hear you talk, there really is this disorientation that happens, mm-hmm. like the whole world drops out from under your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, for me, I never got to have really words with her, but there's always that feeling of unfinished business.
Yes.
So, yeah.
That's the hardest part of sudden death. As opposed to a lingering death where you do have some time, even if the person's in a coma, you get to say some words that they may hear. But with a sudden death and the 9/11 tragedy where there were no bodies found,
right?
It's very hard to.
So tell me, Greg, with you, your son knew he was going to die, but for you, it was very much sudden death, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. It had never occurred to me that he really did know what he was talking about. None of us. So my wife's a minister, but in our church spiritual belief, magic really was not possible. So no, we didn't expect it. But it was so well orchestrated.
Mm-hmm.
And the day he died, a lot of paranormal things happened. Came home, and he'd put a note up on his door, "Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me." That was his final note.
Oh.
And he put up his final parents' poll right where we walked in the door, very first thing we saw. And for the first time, he gave us a perfect 2000.
Cool.
So, he was making it as easy as he could. But, of course, we were in shock and devastated. But what I discovered was, I wrote a poem for one of the chapter breaks, when you're in grief, you're really living in the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this emptiness is legend. Okay, Buddhists talk about it all the time. Even science, they don't teach correct science in school. But the correct science is that what we consider is emptiness, empty space, has infinite energy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the equations show that. We don't have the mathematics to deal with that, so we create a very finite, it's called renormalization. But mm-hmm. the reality is, it's infinite. Also, our mathematics teaches us that everything we know, no matter how much you know, there's more. Okay? And what that does, it teaches us that there is infinite knowledge. That is what our mathematics mm-hmm. tells us.
Yeah.
We don't teach that to people. Mm-hmm. So this emptiness is really the source of infinite energy and infinite intelligence. And when you're in grief, you're in it. It's taking you over. Now, if you're open to it, then things can happen that are beyond your intelligence and beyond your your understanding, but your life can change in ways you don't understand. But you have to honor the emptiness that your loved one left you with. Mm-hmm. And the love that you felt for them is still there, and it becomes less conditional, more unconditional if you allow it. That unconditional love really is the emptiness. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the poem, a little short, a little poem. Our emptiness calls us to heal and gives us a birthing place for what we cannot imagine and what we could not face.
Mm-hmm. You're the perfect example of the creativity I was talking about in terms of honoring someone's life, your own life, and your own journey. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, you know what? This takes me to a question that you prompted at the beginning of your talk, which is, what do we do when your own experience is impossible? So, Pam, you first go, and then we'll let Greg talk about that.
What do you mean by impossible? Because death is certainly possible.
Right. But you talk about having a relationship mm-hmm. even when the person isn't there. Some might say mm-hmm. that's impossible.
That's true, but that's, I don't care.
So you didn't have any problem accepting mm-hmm. that relationship, that there was no doubt. Often when our intuition or we have a spiritual experience, mm-hmm. we doubt ourselves.
Now I get where you're going with this. Okay, yes. One of the first experiences I had of connecting with George was probably the most profound, and that is... like many of you might have done, I went to see a psychic medium, and because I was getting sort of inputs, but I felt, it's a crazy time going through grief. In fact, my sister's therapist at the time, she said to him, how did you survive the death of your own wife? And the therapist said, I went crazy. So you can feel crazy and doubt what's coming through. So I went to see this psychic medium, and you don't, as you know, wear jewelry or anything that might give away what you're about. You just get a number or something. So I sat down with her, and her first words were, "Who's George?" And I said, "Why'd you say that?" Because that's his name, And she said, "Well, he's here, and I don't know what to do." She said, "Because he looks like Superman." And I said, "Oh my gosh, my favorite picture of George was dressed up as Superman flying our son around the living room." Okay, so for me, that was a big affirmation. And then she went on to say I was going to write a book, that I was going to be on TV, yada, 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 and a lot of it came true. So that was a validation for me that I wasn't crazy.
Yeah. So how about you, Greg? That was your question, what do you do when your own experience is impossible? You came out of a science background. Mm-hmm. Pam might have had more of an orientation to what this is all about, but you... And from her spiritual path, but you were coming from a much more scientific field where people were often doubting that anything that wasn't measurable was happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'd been raised and trained as a in-your-head scientist, and I'd been told that there was absolutely no reasonable data, studies to show that paranormal experiences exist, which is absolutely false. I mean, I have since looked at everything I could find. After Brian died, my belief systems were totally blown apart, and I researched everything I could, and all of these teachers showed up by incredible synchronicities, and I basically, like remote viewing, the people that started the remote viewing program for the government are here in Charlottesville.
Yes.
Okay? And you sit there and you remote view. And in medicine, the reason everybody takes aspirin to prevent a heart attack is because it cuts down the incidence of a second heart attack by a half of a percent. Okay? And if you do huge studies, you can't see that difference, but you can measure it, and then everybody takes it. So medicine, the data that we use, the effects are so small, but in remote viewing... If you would do it by chance, guess one of four pictures, you'd be right 25% of the time. But good remote viewers would be right 50% of the time. Mm-hmm. Okay? There's a huge difference. And a lot of them will draw exactly the picture that was in the sealed envelope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which is way beyond. So, you sit in the room, you do this, and you read the studies. And so really, there's a lot of misinformation in the media. So I came to grips with that, and basically our culture, I guess you could say I had crazy experience, but actually that was real, and what we're taught in the media, that is crazy.
One of my favorite stories in Greg's book is that he would take envelopes into a children's classroom, and he would, in one envelope, have a picture of a serial killer, and the other a picture of his children. And he would say, if you were to pick, he was trying to teach them about trusting their gut, feeling in your belly, you know, mm-hmm. if you were to eat this, how would it feel? And he would ask them, you know, one of these two you could have a play date with, and who would you prefer? And when the children touched it and felt into that, what there was a high percentage did not want to play with the serial killer, but wanted
Isn't
to play with your kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It was, for the bad guy, the sealed envelope, they were just supposed to imagine eating it, and they closed their eyes and raised their hand if it felt good or bad. So we had like nine bads and three goods, and then with Brian and Matt, we had 12 goods and one bad.
Wow.
So, I mean, these kind of studies are way beyond the stuff that's normally reported.
What's true, Greg, also, is that science is coming closer and closer to spirituality, mm-hmm. especially with the physicists who can't explain certain things, and they keep trying. You know,
mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
You watch The Big Bang Theory? That's a great show. I learn a lot from that. But the point is that, you know, they're looking for the glue that holds us together, and they can't quite identify it.
Absolutely. Well, so I'm going to lob this next question at you, Pam, and then go to Greg. We're talking about some spiritual awakening, some real deepening in terms of our relationships with people who even aren't here anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, what are the gifts in the tragedy? That's one of my favorite questions mm-hmm. to ask a client is, mm-hmm. what is the gift here? Even when it looks dark and mm-hmm. and like, you know, and there's nothing there.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
no, actually, there's more to it than that. One of the gifts was an opening up. As a therapist and as a coach, my heart became way open towards people who are going through any kind of loss. And I never judge whatever the loss is. In fact, I actually counseled people, a couple last year, who lost their dog. Hello, you know, and they went through profound grief over this, what they called their child. And so, I have this amazingly open heart, and then my interfaith training has helped, but I think George's death also helped me to truly honor anybody's journey, wherever the journey may take them. If they're Buddhist and it takes them a certain place, if they're Christian, it takes them a certain place. Anger at God is appropriate. Although when I was in the hallways of the hospital when George had died, I was shaking my fist at God, and I think it was, I don't want to judge her, I think it was a Jehovah's Witness person or something like that. And she came up to me and she said, you can't be angry at God. I said, hell, I can't. Watch me. And if you don't want to watch, leave. So in any case, that's some of the gifts. And of course, my creative self just bloomed after this book.
Well, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, but first I want to tag on that. At the time, I grew up Catholic, and I was seeing a priest, and he actually said, go ahead and get angry at God. He's big enough, or she's
Good
big enough
him.
To take it.
Good
and that was very freeing for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Psalms in the Bible are full of anger at God.
Right.
People shaking their fists.
Exactly. And I try to remember that as a mother. Okay, if my kids are mad at me, I should be big enough to be able to take that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So just to take this a little further, and then I'll ask Greg the same question. Did you find in all your research people pretty consistently felt there were some gifts in the tragedy?
About 50% were able to get there.
Uh-huh.
Not everybody can, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You have to adjust your mindset to get around, to move from the unfortunate to the fortune in it. You just have to, but some people can't get there, and that's their journey.
Yeah, I remember my stepfather saying that when his wife died, he spent a year or two about why. And then mm-hmm. it finally dawned on him that that was the wrong question to ask.
Oh, yeah, the why.
Because you can get really stuck in that.
And you can get stuck in what I call the if-only mind game, where you run over and over again. Maybe I shouldn't have told him to get on that bus. Maybe if I'd only said goodbye the right way. A lot of the 9/11 people I worked with mm-hmm. had unending stories of that. Not so much the why, which is interesting,
that
but
is interesting.
The what could I have done differently to prevent my husband or wife from going to work that day?
Mm. So for you, Greg, what was the gift and the tragedy? I mean, you've talked about it quite a bit in terms of the teachers in your life. Mm-hmm. Anyone expand on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. The backstory on the book was that when Brian died, nobody would tell the story. The media... Now, Brian, there were at least 50 people that knew that we were dealing with the fact he said he was going to die, and maybe another 100 people came to our house and saw his picture and his parents' poll and everything. So it made the National Wire Services, and a lot of reporters called, and I'd tell them the story, and they wouldn't follow up. You know, they wouldn't. You know, I thought, this is the most provable case I've ever heard where somebody knows the future, and nobody would tell the story. Yeah. So now the problem I had was that I didn't understand it, and then the other thing was that nobody was a worse writer than I was. I could write technical things, but in high school I was the scientific nerd, and I couldn't write anything about feelings. We had a poetry assignment. I had asked my parents to do it for me. I absolutely could not express myself. And there was no creativity at all. So nobody would tell the story, so I had to tell it. I would just mm-hmm. write and write and write, and I wrote a lot of bad stuff. But eventually, the story was so powerful, it forced me to tell it well, to tell it truthfully. And so now people tell me it's a well-written book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that's one of it, was the fact that he taught me how to... You know, and the other thing is, just like you hear at all the writing workshops, the good stuff you're not writing. You know, if you're controlling it and you got a plan and an outline, it's going to be mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be the stuff that's already been written. And the really good stuff is when you're just, you know, your heart is open and the pen's moving and maybe the tears are coming out onto the page. Mm-hmm. And you read this stuff, and it's like, where did this come from? This
Greg,
is beautiful.
I think George helped me write this book.
Mm-hmm.
There were times when I really felt like I was getting guidance. So I'm, mm. you know, I think that's probably another gift for me.
Absolutely. Well,
are we going to go down?
What we're going to do now is we're going to come down and interact with you all. We don't really like, none of us like up here, like being behind here, mm-hmm. away from you guys. So we're going to come down. And what I'm going to do is, if it's in the front row, I'll handle it, and if it's back, I'll call you up.
And before we go down, how many of you have experienced a loss in this room? I'm just curious. Yeah, okay. Just about everybody.
Isn't this so much better down here?
Yes, for me it is.
All three of us were like, oh, and I do programs in this room every year, and it's a mm-hmm. it's a great facility, but boy, I feel like I'm in a barrier back there.
It does feel like a barrier.
So who has a question?
I lost a brother to suicide 25 years ago, and I lost another brother and his wife in a house fire in 2008. And in Connecticut, not here, that might have been a fire that was set intentionally. Mm-hmm. We don't know. So it might have been a murder, double murder. And in both cases, and especially with a brother 25 years ago, there was some difficulty in the mm-hmm. relationship. So I guess, which I've struggled with and sure. Done poetry and done a lot of work with. Mm-hmm. But I'd like one or both of you or all three of you just to talk about violent death and or death where there is not just a good relationship, where there mm-hmm. is pain in the relationship.
Yeah,
it complicates things a lot.
I'd like to speak to that. Do I need the mic?
One of the things that I'm aware of is that the communication continues. So if you've got unfinished business, if it was a difficult relationship, my belief system allows for the fact, and it doesn't have to be yours, but it allows for the fact that there's been a transitional moment when the person crosses over that makes them easier than they were in life because of the physical boundaries of life. So you might try a communication. You've been doing that good.
Yeah, I'm not looking as much for personal suggestions, although I appreciate that. It's more just speaking in general to people's needs when either, you know, they're 3 months or a year away and there's a lot of pain there that's in addition to the grief. Right. And so I think it's, you know,
You're talking about unfinished business.
Yeah, and I'm saying that I don't need as much personally. I've had a lot. I've had tremendous gifts. And people there to support me and a group, and we did a book of poetry and paintings. And
wonderful.
But just sort of how people, you know, how to deal with that. So.
Mm-hmm. You want to speak to it?
Well, that's that was something I really appreciated when I was around the other parents that had lost children, and that I realized that Brian had given us an opportunity for pure grief. There was no guilt. Everything was, you know, I mean, how do you grieve something that was supposed to happen? And so, whereas the other parents had guilt about the two-year-old that drowned in the swimming pool and things like that, and we didn't have to deal with that, for which I was great, you know, I'm very, very grateful. It seemed anytime you're trying to heal an old wound, like childhood abuse, things like that, what you need before you go back to it, to this unfinished business, you need to be in touch with a purer love than you were before. Okay? And now that he's gone, sometimes that's even easier. But the only thing that will work is to have, and you can get that from community too, community support. You go back to those issues with greater love that you had then.
That's good too. That's wonderful the way you put that. And in my book, this is the commercial announcement, there are a lot of suggestions in there for each stage of the grief. The first week, the first months, the first years.
And I'd just like to add that I always tell clients when they talk about this that one of the things is that I feel like you said, people are at a much higher level as they've left and they know. I mean, I felt like I never got to tell my daughter I loved her. And, you know, she came to me in a dream and it was like, I know. So, yeah.
Yeah, dreams are cool, aren't they?
Yeah.
That was some like people, an I'm okay dream.
Yes.
And that's a common theme. Well, Brian left us a sign, I'm okay. But he came to us in dreams, and that's probably the most common dream, is the I'm okay dream. They come, they're well cared for, and they...
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and it's harder on you than it is on them.
You know, some people never get the dream, okay? Don't feel upset if you've never gotten a dream or a contact, okay? They're still, I believe, still with you, whether or not you get a visible sign or not.
Wonderful.
And there's something else that I have seen in my own experience, that I've also heard from other people too, is that when somebody dies, okay, you can be positive or negative. My mother, who was a real difficult person, died, and she was up in Chicago. I used to just visit her twice a year. After she died, she wasn't just up in Chicago.
There's a Woody Allen movie where she's up in the sky and she's watching and she says, put on your galoshes, and she's driving them crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all kinds of disasters befell. The kind that would only happen when I was visiting her life, my job and my health and all kinds of stuff like that. Okay, so what I learned from that and several other things, too, is that when somebody dies, you're dealing with a magical situation, magical being, it's beyond what we're taught in normal reality. Okay, and what they had both positive and negative is up for grabs. If somebody has a really good, you know, somebody who, like mm-hmm. like your brother, had some good quality, then that becomes, you can own it.
Yes,
it
can
come to you. Mm-hmm. Same with the negative too, but it's it becomes universal.
There's a question there. Sorry.
Well, we are ready for, you want to finish that sentence?
And no, then
we'll
add,
okay. Who has the next question?
You mentioned Robert Monroe as one of your teachers. This morning at another session, mm-hmm. Frank DeMarco mentioned mm-hmm. Robert right. Monroe. Can you tell me what the significance of his teachings, whatever they are, worked was mm-hmm. to you?
Okay, Robert Monroe was set up the first cable company here in Charlottesville. But prior to that, he was a very successful radio entrepreneur. And he was experimenting. The story is, although it's, you know, it's not quite the way it was portrayed. He was experimenting with different sound technologies when he started having out-of-body experiences. Mm. And then this led to altered states and a lot of self-learning, okay? So what he did was he started experimenting with other people here to use that to make it so it was much easier to get altered states than if you just meditated. So you can get someplace in a week that it would take a yogi maybe 10 years
yeah.
To get to as far as altered states. So he set up the Monroe Institute for that. And the government, when they started doing some of the psychic research stuff, came there and found out that mm-hmm. this hemisync sound patterns facilitated a lot of the psychic stuff they were doing too.
And we actually had the head of the Monroe Institute last year at this event. And although you can go and experience it there, you can also buy CDs. And I actually write to the CDs because they're very focusing. Yeah.
Well, I've never said this out loud in front of a bunch of people I don't know, but it's about time. In 1981, my brother, with whom I was really close, was traveling in South America, and he never came back. So he's the opposite of a sudden death. He's like a 31-year, not even maybe dead yet, kind of. And in order for him to really be dead to me, I have to kill him. And I wonder if you had any, you know, insights about how to... Mm-hmm. Proceed with that.
It feels like a never-ending yeah. loss,
yeah.
doesn't it? Yes. I don't know what to tell you except that some of the people who came to me after 9/11 and said they didn't have a body or a place to go to grieve or what were they going to do, is that this is one of these imponderables. What the hell can you do? I really don't have an answer for you, except to acknowledge how difficult it must be for you to not have an end there.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's the most difficult griefs are when there's no body mm-hmm. and when there's no support, when there's isolation and helplessness. Mm-hmm. So the way you deal with that is you do the opposite of isolation. You know, you have a mm-hmm. community help you. A ritual is very nice. Okay, where you're actually not helpless, but you're helpful, okay? And whether you want to bury something of his or whatever it is like that.
My guess is, though, she vacillates between hope, you know, a little bit of hope.
Oh, you think he may still be alive?
He may still be alive.
For all I know, I don't know.
She has no
clue.
I
do not know.
I see. Okay, right. Yeah, so you really are in limbo. Okay.
But congratulations on speaking out today, because that's the beginning of a journey towards making some meaning out of all this.
Mm-hmm. I would say to that, I would say, see what that limbo is like and see where it wants to take you. Because if you trust it, it will take you somewhere.
And you may get some guidance about a ritual that's not about burying, but about... allowing some peace, sending peace or something. Yeah. Okay, I saw a question over here.
At what age was Brian becoming aware that his death was going to take place? And you had mentioned also that he had been suffering from depression, and I was wondering whether you had brought him perhaps to the scientific community, a neurologist or a psychiatrist, and I wanted to know what their response was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Brian wasn't depressed until right before his birthday, ninth birthday. And that was 6 months before he died. Okay? And right around then, he started getting very depressed. We took him to a my field is pain, and I'm always working with psychologists and psychiatrists. And I always felt like I was an amateur. And my wife is a professional. We couldn't come up with anything, mm-hmm. and we took him to a very good child psychologist, and we couldn't find any issues other than the fact that because he was really dealing with his real death, and the and he overcame it on his own. Mm-hmm. And so, well, really not on his own, but he overcame it in ways we didn't understand.
Yes.
So he healed without our intervention is really what happened.
Mm-hmm. My son Ryan died, it'll be 2 years in May. And I actually feel very, well, fortunate for a couple of things. One, in that he was an amazing son, and I feel like I was really blessed to have him. And I really believe he was a gift from God. But I was very fortunate to have a lot of spiritual connection from him for quite a while. I haven't had a dream or anything since before the end of last year. But I guess, and I know he's happy and I know he's with God, but I don't see how you can really feel that it. I don't really ever see me feeling that it's fortunate.
Mm-hmm. I didn't say fortunate. I said the fortune in it, meaning the gift. When I said moving from an unfortunate situation or death to the fortune in it.
But I don't know what that means.
Meaning the gift in his. I know it takes time. This doesn't happen overnight. That part of it doesn't happen suddenly. Mm-hmm. It takes time. And you're still grieving. You're still actively grieving and perhaps feeling like it's never going to end. And it never will end. The intensity of it will diminish with time. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry you misunderstood what I had said. Did anybody else misunderstand what I had said? Okay.
If I may say, there's no greater loss. Okay? Mm-hmm. And my experience was, and you could tell that 20 years later, I still have trouble, mm-hmm. Getting through some of the story. The passion is still there.
You okay. couldn't see it, but he was tearing up at times. Yeah.
So, and what I would say is the passion that you feel is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It will just change. Instead of being attached as much as it was to him as he was when he was here, if you just keep in touch with that, the memory of him starts to change. And when it does, if you stay in touch with your feelings, something will change. I don't know what it is.
And on your timetable, nobody else's.
Right. And that's okay. His gift. Okay? And then, so yes, even in the worst thing that could happen can be the most powerful transformation. I don't know what it will be. All I know is when I see people like you and me, I never see people change as much mm-hmm. as people like us.
Yeah.
I'd just like to say that my understanding of
this
accepting
is
the loss is that when we come into this life, we come in with certain assignments, mm-hmm. certain tasks that we have to complete. And I believe that once we have completed those things, then we leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps me to accept, mm-hmm. that did help me to accept my husband's death. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's it. So they have a job, they do
it didn't
and then
come,
they say goodbye.
It didn't come to, this is my sister, it didn't come to you immediately. It took
no.
a while for that to bubble up. And
oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
Greg, have you heard of other people, especially children, who actually predicted
Good
their
question.
Death?
Oh, yeah. And I mentioned that a little bit in the book. But when I once I started going to the Compassionate Friends, it took me months before I could go, and then it took me a year before I could talk, you know, and then it took me another year before I could tell Brian's story. And I told Brian's story, and then the other parents started talking about their story. And half of them had stories where the kid clearly, admissible as evidence for court, had clearly known that they were going to die of an accidental death. I mean, one mother brought in the picture of her four-year-old. It sounded a lot like, her kid sounded so much like Brian. She said, oh, my four-year-old daughter has always been full of, you know, full of joy, creative, and she died on a playground, went down a slide in a ribbon caught around her neck and strangled her. And she showed the picture that this girl drew 20 minutes before she died, showing her in dark colors hanging from the neck. And over on the side, her in bright colors putting on a halo with an angel in the sky dropping more halos.
That beautiful story? That's beautiful.
Yeah. And she said, you know, Stephanie always said she never wanted to grow up and go to school like the other children. She was like, every day she would say, you know what, I love you with a mad passion. Can you imagine that from a four-year-old? Okay, so I thought Brian's story was so unique. And then half the parents had stories like that. And I've heard so many because people know they can tell me about it, but the problem is we don't have permission to share those stories, and they're so healing. Yes. Because the parents go, oh, I thought I was the only one. Mm-hmm. Because until I told Brian's story, year after year, nobody ever talked about these things.
And the 9/11 families I've worked with had stories also, very similar, that their husband somehow knew or their wife somehow knew, but they didn't put the pieces together. But what could we have done? You know, you can't prevent it.
This will be our last question, and then we'll close it. That book is.
So maybe I can make room for somebody else. I just wanted to mention, because I know our culture doesn't do grief very well, Saban Fu Somme does a grief ritual. And I believe that if we were able to grieve, we'd see our gifts more clearly.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful, it was recommended to me by a social worker, Saban Fu Somme, S-O-M-E.
And wonderful. Is there a web page or something?
Yes, it's on Facebook, and you can Google Saban Fu Somme. She's from an African tribe, but she's brought the culture here to us because we need it.
Some of those African tribes really know how to grieve. They scream. I have a screaming exercise in the book, which is lots of fun.
So we do have time for one more question.
This young lady here.
It looks like whether you raise your hand or not, they're going to make you
take it. We're not going to let you get away.
Well, I had a question for Greg, but I would like your input on it, too. I don't know what your spirituality was beforehand, before your son died, but I was wondering, how did you receive the messages? I don't know, because you said it was, out of your church's practice to believe in magic, so I wasn't sure, you know, how you go about, how someone who's not really spiritually in tune that way receives messages.
Okay. I was a church-going agnostic.
Interesting.
Agnostic, maybe.
Married to a minister.
Maybe even, yeah, right. And maybe even a little bit of an atheist. Okay. And then I got blown apart. You know, obviously the world was different. And then I went to the Monroe Institute, where you go for these like guided meditation workshops for a week. For me, it was a magical place. And all of these, as I started going into these different dream worlds, I discovered they're more real than this world, and they're more intelligent. And if you can allow yourself to let go of this, and your love, my love for my son, who is now part of this emptiness, was my pathway. And then the most incredible things happened. And then I got kind of melted down and recast by unconditional love. And then I started having more paranormal experiences, too. So, but I'd say the biggest thing was that synchronicities just showed up.
Yes.
And if you want something, you know, it would show up. And so it happens in dreams, it happens in meditation, but what's so cool, it happens in physical reality. The only thing is I realized that I would not allow it in before.
Yeah. Yes.
But you see, now Brian is part of it, and of course I want to stay in touch with him. So now I'm open to him, who is now no longer just Brian. If I had just kept him as Brian, and there was a goodbye.
Yes.
There's another common dream called the goodbye dream. And what they're telling you is it's time for you to let go. And that is because for both him and you, it's confining for you just to hold on to them the way they were. They can be so much more if you allow them.
That's wonderful. I'd like to say that it's trusting yourself, too, when you get those experiences, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Would you like to speak to that?
Well, I told you over the phone the other day that I still use George as my angel, okay, and he's available. So, you know, although some people may say, well, you're holding on to him, I think there's a little piece of him left that to do my bidding, and I send him out on special projects. And I even ask him for parking spaces once in a while. And it sounds like Brian is the gift that keeps on giving, so I'm going to, you know, I like what your philosophy was, too. There's room for all the philosophies.
So as we close, I'd like you guys to just give like a closing thought, and then I'd really like to encourage you, you know, our authors are doing this as a gift of love, but they also want to sell books, so I encourage you to come up and talk to them and maybe buy a book. So go ahead and each of you have a closing thought, and then we'll move to the book signing.
All right. My closing thought is, yes, death does end a relationship. Death does end a life, but it doesn't end the relationship if you want it to continue, if you want it to feed you, to feed your creativity, the gift that keeps on giving. If you want to embrace that, that's perfectly okay and normal. And I think, I hesitate to use the word should, but you should. Embrace the fortune in the unfortunate.
And my closing thought would be, even the worst thing that could possibly happen can be a way home.
Nice.
Very nice. Well, thank you all so much for being here. Let's thank our authors.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.